Welcome to the KMUD News. I'm your news director, April Lewis, and I'm glad to be with you for this broadcast. In this episode, we have stories on Redway's Q Zone, the Rick Toledo case, and on the MP18 fire in Hoopa. But first, some local alerts and updates. This is KMUD News. From the Humboldt Planning Department. The Humboldt County Planning and Building Department is developing an ordinance to allow low-impact camping areas in rural unincorporated Humboldt County and is seeking input from the community. A workshop will be held at the Planning Commission meeting on Thursday, August 20th at 6 p.m. to share information and receive input from the Planning Commission and the public. Assembly Bill 518 was passed in October of 2025. This bill allows counties to permit small-scale and low-impact camping on private rural roads without a state permit. Since the bill was passed, the Planning and Building Department has been working to develop a low-impact camping area ordinance that follows state law and local health, safety, and welfare standards. Drafts of both the inland and coastal versions of the ordinance have been reviewed by state and local agencies, including the Building Division, Department of Environmental Health, California Department of Fish and Wildlife, CAL FIRE, California Coastal Commission, and the Farm Bureau. Their input has been considered for incorporation into the draft ordinances. An updated draft of the inland version was released to the public for review on July 8th, and a public workshop on this version was held on July 15th. Public comment has been received, and county staff have updated the draft ordinance, which will now be discussed at a workshop at the Planning Commission meeting on Thursday, August 20th. The county is still working to address the California Coastal Commission's comments on the coastal version of the ordinance, which is not currently available to the public. Once this document is ready to move forward, there will be opportunity for public comment at a future Planning Commission meeting. If you would like to be part of the discussion on this ordinance, please attend the workshop at the Planning Commission meeting on Thursday, August 20th at 6 p.m. Community members have the option to attend on Zoom or in person at the Humboldt County Board of Supervisors Chamber, located in the Humboldt County Courthouse at 825 5th Street in Eureka. From Caltrans District 1. Recent Ferndale High School graduate Tyler Birdie has been selected to receive the 2026 Caltrans District 1 Transportation Scholarship. The $2,250 award will support Birdie's enrollment in the Heavy Equipment Operations Program at Butte College in Oroville this month. The 18-year-old said the scholarship will help him take an important step toward a career where he can make a meaningful impact. Quote, "I'm excited about the opportunity to work outdoors, operate machinery, and contribute to projects that benefit thousands of people every day. A career in transportation will allow me to combine my passion for hands-on work with my desire to serve my community," end quote. Selected through a competitive process, Birdie's application stood out due to his background in community service, participation in extracurricular activities, and commitment to pursuing a career in the transportation field. District 1's Transportation Scholarship supports the professional growth of high school seniors or college or technical school students from Del Norte, Humboldt, Lake, or Mendocino counties who are seeking a career in transportation. And up next, our main stories. This is KMUD News. The MP18 fire in Hoopa Valley continues to be a challenging situation, KMUD News reports. The MP18 fire in Hoopa Valley continues to be a complex and challenging incident for firefighters. Since the fire started on Friday, State Route 96 has been closed in the area, and that closure continues between 3.9 and 8.3 miles east of Hoopa. Most of the eastern side of the Hoopa Valley is under evacuation warnings, plus new evacuation warning zones south of Weechpec and west of Route 96. However, one zone, HIA-E002-A, has been moved to an evacuation order as of this broadcast recording on the afternoon of Wednesday, August 12th. That zone is north of Mill Creek Road, south of Coyote Creek and Hopkins Creek, west of North Fork Mill Creek, and east of Highway 96. Thankfully, the zone under an evacuation order is primarily a wilderness area with little to no development or housing. However, evacuation warnings have expanded in the Hoopa Valley, and listeners impacted should check the Watch Duty app. The fire currently stands at an estimated 2,803 acres as of this recording, with 10% containment. Containment has not been trending up, and that is likely due to the extremely rugged and steep terrain combined with heavy vegetation in the area. We spoke with Kyle Zayer, information officer for the Interagency California 1 team that is now in charge of MP-18 fire operations in the Hoopa Valley. Kyle first gave an update on current operations.
Our team assumed command of the fire yesterday. We continue to have more resources to arrive. Our two first priorities are trying to keep the fire on the southern edge in check at Mill Creek to try to keep to protect the community of Hoopa. The other priority is 96 corridor. We got a lot of crews along the 96 corridor, trying to keep it on the east side of the Trinity River and not have it pass over to the west side. And any opportunities we do have crews working around the clock on all sides of the fire. Any opportunity that the fire and the terrain gives us to kind of keep it in check, we're actively engaging and trying to keep it in check.
Kyle Zayer, information officer for the interagency team in charge of MP-18 fire operations, also spoke on the double-edged sword of current weather conditions in the Hoopa Valley. Morning inversions are tempering the fire, but causing worse air quality in the region, followed by afternoons when the fire has opportunity to spread.
So weather, we've been getting kind of an inversion in the morning, which tempers the fire a little bit, but it increases smoke in the area and for the communities, and so that's kind of a big impact. But then as the atmosphere kind of lifts in the afternoon, that's when we see the fire grow and want to make its run. So the afternoon is when we usually see the highest level of active activity.
Kyle also spoke on the wide response for the MP-18 blaze in the Hoopa Valley, including many personnel from multiple states and across California assisting.
We have we do have a lot of folks here from California, all different parts of the state, it's an all hands on deck situation. We're in what they call planning level 5 nationally, so there's a lot of fires all over the West Coast and things, and so we're pulling in anybody that has qualifications all over the country. We can get them. We'll bring them and try to get them around. So the team is based here out of California, but for example, I'm out of Arizona, and we have other people from other states, Wisconsin and other states too, just in my little cubicle here.
Lastly, Kyle Zayer, information officer for the California 1 team in Hoopa, spoke on the challenging conditions ground crews face with the MP-18 blaze going up and down steep slopes.
It's more difficult for the ground crews for sure to access certain places and just the fuel loads that are in some of the places if it's real thick, it can encourage the fire to either climb up slope or run down.
We will continue to keep KMUD listeners updated on the MP-18 fire impacting the Hoopa Valley. A huge thank you to all firefighters and emergency personnel working on this incident. Our thoughts are with you. Reporting for KMUD, I'm April Lewis. the old growth tree protection zone in Lower Redway will be improved, and Humboldt County supervisors will also consider a countywide ordinance. Daniel Mintz reports.
The provisions of Lower Redway's tree protection zoning will be updated, and Humboldt County's Board of Supervisors is also considering extending them countywide. Known as a Q-zone, the Lower Redway zoning area sets standards for tree removals on properties less than 3 acres that are not zoned for timber production. Updating it was called for at the August 11th supervisors meeting. The need to do so is triggered by a Lower Redway property owner's controversial removal of 4 old-growth trees last winter. The county was under the mistaken impression that CAL FIRE is in charge and the trees were cut without a county permit. After public outcry, a 5th tree was sought to be cut under a county permit, which was unanimously denied by the Planning Commission last June. Planning Director John Ford summarized that history and explains here how the Q-zone can be updated to work better.
Number one is the ordinance identifies that trees can be removed if it's an imminent danger of falling and thus creating an imminent hazard. That's a little bit hard to interpret. It'd be better to give some more clarity to what an imminent danger is and what an immediate hazard is, because trees can pose hazards for other reasons than just falling. And it should be clear from the county's perspective what that means and under what circumstances that a tree could be successfully considered for removal. And to correlate with that, there should be a more robust requirement process for determining the health and the safety of the tree. This would involve developing standards for reports from both arborists and foresters to lay out the amount of information that should be included in a report so that the decision makers can have a clear understanding from a very technical standpoint of the health of the tree. And it should be documented either with photo evidence or other kinds of evidence to demonstrate that the tree is either healthy or not healthy. And then the ordinance currently requires notification of people within the Q zone. If you're either south of Bryce Thurnton Road or north of it, and it should be modified that everybody within that Q zone be notified. I think the other thing that we would recommend is that there should be a requirement that these requirements to protect the trees should end up on title for the property, so that prospective property owners would realize that there may be dangers associated with living in a forested environment and what the limitations are in terms of working on those trees.
The situation has been followed beyond Redway, and Ford said there's been conversation about the desire to protect old growth trees throughout the county. Hence, another recommendation is to develop an ordinance that would protect old growth trees countywide. During a public comment period, Redway resident Sue Maloney was one of several speakers who said the community should be involved in an updated Q-zone ordinance.
I think that it's really important, instead of having just planning or just a couple people make these decisions, I think we need to have a committee to clarify and strengthen a lot of the details that we're talking about, and we are in agreement with a lot of them. The one about getting this information on the title is awesome. I think that a committee should include Lower Redway residents. It should include planning commissioners, like a couple of them definitely expressed an interest on June 18th. It should include arborists, including PG&E arborists, who I think do a really good job down there. And I think we can't underestimate PG&E's role in their concern about the trees and the power lines down there. It should include parks, and it should include fish and wildlife, and it should include the tribes.
Other speakers emphasized the need for assuring that the Q-zone's protections are heeded into the future. Ford said the Q-zone update will be thoroughly reviewed before it comes before the board.
I do think that this is not something that can be done in a closet. This has got to be a very public process, whether we work at setting together a specific group that works at it, or just have a lot of public meetings through the process. Either way, it's just got to have a lot of input. It's got to have a lot of input from a lot of different foresters, a lot of different arborists, a lot of different concerned individuals of the community and the greater community of Humboldt County. Appreciate the idea that PG&E is off and down there working. For sure, the state park is affected by this.
Supervisors unanimously approved development of an updated Q zone with the changes in public involvement described by Ford. They also approved development of a county-wide Q zone type ordinance, but the vote wasn't unanimous, as Supervisor Rex Bones said it's too enveloping and voted against it. His was the only dissent vote. Supervisor Michelle Bushnell said she's not sure about a countywide ordinance, but is open to a discussion on it. An interim Q-zone-type countywide moratorium on tree removals will also come back to supervisors. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Back in February, a pro-Palestine, BDS-aligned student sit-in and protests shut down Nelson Hall on the Cal Poly Humboldt campus for a day. Student activists occupying the building, campus administration locking it down in response, and police ultimately clearing the campus after 2 in the morning. In the middle of all that, a university staff member who was posted to keep people out of the building says he was assaulted and falsely imprisoned by one of the students. Now, nearly 6 months later, a Humboldt County judge is weighing whether to force the return of that protester's phone, computer, and other devices. Seized by campus police in the weeks after, and still in government custody today. Ryan Hudson reports.
A Humboldt County judge is weighing whether to force the return of a Cal Poly Humboldt student's phone, computer, and other devices seized by campus police back in March, which are still being held by the DA's office 5 months later. The hearing was attended by the defendant, Richard Toledo, and his civil rights and defense counsel, while a small group of supporters observed the relatively unusual hearing from the gallery. The Honorable Judge Stephen Stewart noted at the outset of the hearing that this type of motion was a first for him. Following the hearing, we spoke with attorney Matthew Kellegrew of the Civil Liberties Defense Center, who's representing student activist Rick Toledo. Kellegrew explained the court proceedings and how we arrived here.
A few things happened. Starting, there was a protest, there was an arrest, Rick Toledo was charged with a crime, right? We know that, but before the charges ever came down, there was an investigation. First, Rick was arrested, then Rick was searched. Two separate incidents, all right, not happening on the same day. They're like a month apart. So the first warrant authorizing arrest, that's a Ramey warrant. We challenged that, and we challenged that on a legal basis, that it was improperly executed. It should have been done during the daytime hours. It was done in the middle of the night in his home. Okay, we took the position that's an illegal arrest for misdemeanor charges. The second warrant was a search warrant. That search warrant basically alleged that Mr. Toledo was engaged in the crime of conspiracy, and that evidence of that conspiracy would be found on his gaming laptop and his PCs and his hard drives and his phones. They took every piece of technology he owned. Okay? They had it. They had it for maybe 2 months. They charged him. Did not charge him with conspiracy. Did not charge him with a felony at all. Charged him with misdemeanor crimes. Okay? Misdemeanor crimes that have no relationship with his technology, with any of his possessions, his computers, his phones, and stuff like that.
Right.
So we filed a motion that said, challenge the illegality of the arrest for the reasons I mentioned. Challenge the search warrant for constitutional reasons, as well as for being overbroad, constitutionally overbroad. So there are many different. Each one of those is a reason to deny, to grant our request and shut down the warrant.
So why were the devices taken in the first place? Kellegrew says the whole case traces back to a single phone call.
In this case, no one called 911. The individual who is the alleged victim of this case called the police non-emergency line.
Right.
He got routed through to the officer who you see testify, and that officer didn't go out to visit him at the scene. She called him on the phone, and she had a phone conversation with him where she said, "What happened?" And he described what happened. And then the police officer said, would you like to prosecute? And he said, yes. And she hung up the phone. End of investigation. No one ever went to the scene. No one ever interviewed a witness. No one looked for any evidence. They didn't look at any surveillance camera. It's like all the cop stuff. They didn't do any cop stuff. So based off of this individual phone call, we don't even know how long it lasted, but based on the amount of information in it, it could not have been long, right?
Yeah.
That based off a short phone call with a police officer, that officer just decided, well, there must be a vast criminal conspiracy at play here. And so she went out and got a warrant for it. And we took the position that's not reasonable. It's not constitutional. It's not reasonable.
No one else has ever been charged in connection with that alleged conspiracy, and Toledo believes that's telling. Reacting to the proceedings, Rick Toledo told us he looked forward to the ruling being issued on the 31st.
Yeah, there's been no further arrest. And better yet, during this hearing, the judge asked the prosecution if they had any intention of actually using my technology for anything related to the case. And they simply answered no. So at this point, they're holding things that they stole from me under false pretenses and refusing to give them back while they admit that they have no use for them.
The Humboldt County DA's office argues that the search and arrest were both lawful and that the technology and devices seized remain potentially relevant to the misdemeanor charges Toledo does face. Those include assault, battery, and false imprisonment related to the February protest. Judge Stephen Stewart, the same judge who signed the original warrants, took the motion under submission with a ruling date set for August 31st. Kellegrew, for his part, says he's hoping the case gets stripped down to what it actually is.
It's tricky with these political cases like this, especially a protest case like this, mm-hmm. because there are genuine First Amendment issues. There are genuine constitutional issues. Beyond even the Constitution. Like, this is a microcosm of a larger dialogue about, like, how are we going to deal with each other across these incredibly difficult issues.
Yeah.
Right? Incredibly difficult issues. You know, so it makes a lot of sense why cases like this, and particularly when those issues are front and center, tend to take on that feel. But I would say it's not a monolith, that it's both and.
Yeah.
That it does have all, it contains multitudes, not just the serious constitutional stuff, but also the mundane and the everyday.
Right.
That, like, activist life is, like, actual life. And so that's kind of what I see the main defense goal here is really stripping out the overstatement, the fantasy, the hyperbole from, like, ordinary life. Because when we take this down a notch, when you turn the political temperature down, and you just look at ordinary life and what actually happened between people, this is not a serious felony, you know? And so
yeah.
It's like, that's kind of my hope, is that, hey, let's all come back to reality a bit. We can acknowledge the gravity of the issues that these represent,
yeah.
But what's actually going on in this case, we're not litigating the issue of the Palestinian genocide.
Right.
You know, the Israel genocide in Palestine. That's not going to be before the jury.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like, this is a case about misdemeanor offenses that happen in Humboldt County at the end of it. And it's kind of like, you know, getting us back to the place where we can actually kind of get out of the weird conspiracy world and deal with what is. My hope is that just getting there will be 90% of what we need to do.
To see the full interview with Matthew Kellegrew and Toledo's response, you can find those video interviews at Humboldt Freelance Reporting on YouTube. For KMUD News, this is Ryan Hudson.
California is among a handful of states looking to big business for help covering healthcare costs with new federal work requirements for Medicaid looming. And the cuts they're expected to create. Suzanne Potter reports.
California is among a handful of states looking to big business for help covering healthcare costs with new federal work requirements for Medicaid looming and the cuts they're expected to create. Reporting by KFF Health News finds that a new California bill would require the state to gather data on midsize and large companies whose employees are on Medi-Cal, which provides health care for low-income families. State Senator Lola Smallwood Cuevas, the author of the bill, says it's a first step toward asking companies to help with the costs so they aren't shifted to the taxpayer.
Taxpayers deserve transparency. We need to know who these companies are, and we need to know how many employees they have on Medi-Cal. And then we need those companies to help us cover that health care for their workforce.
The bill has passed the state Senate and is currently before the state Assembly Appropriations Committee. Smallwood Cuevas says it's a response to the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill Act passed by congressional Republicans. It's projected to cut billions from Medi-Cal every year. The data would not be posted publicly, but would inform state efforts to develop a framework for a shared cost system for large employers with workers on Medi-Cal. Nevada passed a law that requires the state to publicly name companies like Amazon and Walmart that employ large numbers of workers on Medicaid. Walmart spokesperson Jimmy Carter says employees there have good health care benefits.
We at Walmart offer affordable, robust medical coverage to the majority of U.S. associates, including eligible part-time associates. Most of our medical plans include access to no-cost care for serious conditions like cancer.
Cuevas estimates that taxpayers contribute about $8,000 a year to cover health care costs for each person on Medi-Cal, which covers 14 million residents. This story was produced with original reporting from Jasmine Orozco Rodriguez with KFF Health News. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
That's all for our news broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our rotation of broadcast engineers, Dennis Marr, Katie Phillips, Bianna Federico, Michael McCaskill, Larry Lashley, and Javier Rodriguez. Also thanks to our reporters for this broadcast, Daniel Mintz and Ryan Hudson. KMA News is now on streaming platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening. You can also follow us on social media at KMA News, including Facebook and Instagram. Do you have issues important to you that deserve more attention? Are there stories we're missing or that you're curious about? You can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio Incorporated is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Sikyone, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilka, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to the region. I'm April Lewis. Stay tuned in.